the summer theme session, a weekly Sunday reflection time whereby we try to tie one week to the next here at the village over the summer by focusing upon a chosen theme that carries through. The theme this summer is taken from a collect that is used so often around here that we've come to call it the Holden Prayer. Some of you may have seen it in the lodges or the chalets. I'll just read to you the entire collect and then point out the theme that we've taken from it. O Lord God, who has called us thy servants to ventures of which we cannot see the ending, by paths as yet untrodden and through perils unknown, give us faith to go out with good courage, not knowing whither we go, but only that thy hand is leading us and thy love supporting us, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. There are a couple of versions of the summer theme. There's a longer version, and I've put that on the board here. Facing the 80s, paths untrodden, perils unknown, and faith to go out with good courage. All of those phrases, except the first one, being drawn from the Holden Prayer. And then there's the shorter version that we refer to frequently, simply faith to go out with good courage. Facing the 80s, faith to go out with good courage. Last night, the Wees focused upon the word faith and did the marvelous musical vespers around. Today, I would like to focus for the first part of this presentation on the two phrases, paths untrodden and perils unknown, and then for the last part of the presentation on the phrase faith to go out with good courage. I want to first face the 80s, look into them, and then secondly talk about the mission of the church in view of what we might sense about the 80s, and at that point related to faith and good courage. So let's call the whole thing the mission of the church in the 80s. I have to admit that I'm immediately suspicious of anyone who claims he or she knows what the mission of the church in the 80s is. We're in a time of considerable disarray, and our statements court illusion if they do not reflect that disarray. So I am deeply suspect of my own conjectures about this decade. I have a new understanding of the quip by Groucho Marx, that he wouldn't accept membership in any club that would admit him. Maybe I'm just projecting my own quandaries onto the world. This topic has generated more starts and finishes than I've grappled with in a long time. I think I've started this reflection more times than Harold Stassen has run for president, and I probably with much the same results in terms of outcome. But let's plunge in. I really know of almost no one or any outlook on this decade, with the possible exception of the Electronic Church and Herman Kahn, that doesn't say the 80s look like a Good Friday world. We're in for a long Lenten season, and we will pray often enough for its end, or at least for a kind of out-of-season Mardi Gras as relief here and there along the way. I'd be absolutely delighted if that general perspective is a skewed one. Say, the dour outlook of a perfectly healthy white American male who's just been beaten around the ears a little too much by black and Native Americans pointing to his racism, feminist theologians holding up the evidence of his sexism, or Latin American liberation theologies pointing out all that evidence of economic and political oppression. But long after I've said my mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, the horizon still looks much the same. It's those other folks that are saying the 80s will bleed more than the 60s and the 70s. It's the sound of alarm that rings from the recent Brandt Commission report on North-South relations and from virtually every major global study of this past decade. Still, they might be wrong, and we may see a comparatively successful negotiation of the major international, societal, and environmental conflicts that we now, at least at this hour, face in such disarray. But what I think is clear is that the 80s represents the most dangerous decade for humanity and the planet generally, since we rather quietly ushered in the nuclear age under the bleachers of the University of Chicago not too long ago. Well, what's the evidence? First of all, there is increased instability in a very fragile world order. That's about as blandly as I can put it. One reason for this increased instability is the proliferation of powerful actors, a great many of them far from the ranks of the authorized shakers and movers. I mean, it is a spectacle when 50 employees in one powerful nation can be held hostage by nameless student militants backed by an austere elderly clergyman who sat for years in a sparse apartment in a Paris suburb. Or that the ambassadors of a dozen nations can negotiate for a long while for release from an island nation's embassy in Colombia. Well, this anarchic proliferation of powerful and often unauthorized actors is no doubt made possible in part by the kind of exposed nerve endings that the electronic media has given the world. All of the messages now move speedily and well, even when they're completely wrong. So the United States Embassy in Islamabad was burned within 24 hours because 1,000 miles away, members of a small Islamic sect attacked the holiest place in Mecca, and the rumor was that the U.S. was party to it. The increased instability is real, and I fear it's something like casting on to the world scene in general of the kind of local and international anarchy that reigned in Europe prior to World War I. If there is an analogy to me, it's a historical analogy, it's something like a kind of Balkanized world where the assassination of a duke can set off a chain reaction. Yet what I deeply fear in the 80s is the convergence in a single decade of sharpened east-west conflicts and growing north-south struggles, have nations, have not nations, converging with the conflicts of increased east-west tension. You know, with either of those, the world would be too much with us. With both of them, it could be a real Humpty Dumpty kind of decade. We're not talking about, I think, a revisit of the Cold War and the 1950s. I don't think that historical analogy holds. For one thing, then the North-South struggles were real, but they were not so desperate as they are now. Environmental threats to sustainability and resources politics were not the kind of factors that they are now in the 50s. And both East and West shared the optimism of growing economies that made it easier to talk about peaceful coexistence. So I think the 80s do not look like the 50s, even though we talk about a new Cold War. But there is a kind of eerie pertinence in what the late Herbert Butterfield wrote in those days. And he wrote this in the 50s in a book entitled Christianity, Diplomacy, and War. The greatest menace to our civilization today is the conflict between giant organized systems of self-righteousness. Each system only too delighted to find that the other is wicked. Each only too glad that the sins give it the pretext for still deeper hatred and animosity. The effect of the whole situation is barbarizing, since both sides take the wickedness of the other as the pretext for insults, atrocities, and loathing, and each side feels that its own severities are not vicious at all, but simply punitive acts and laudable measures of judgment. The international instability now is reinforced by what I'm going to call an upsurge of particularisms. Resurgent Islam is only the most dramatic of these. We had a Washington for Jesus gathering in D.C. A few weeks ago. It's another kind of particularism. But I'm not only talking about an upsurge of religious particularism. I mean ethnic, regional, and national particularisms as well, or zealous groupings of people around any number of ardently contested causes, from gay rights to abortion rights to the solar and nuclear lobbies to Friends of Three Mile Island, or for all I know, broccoli growers for Christ. You know, if those things don't yet exist, just wait till the 80s, they will. It's not only that some of the more desperate or the more ideologically certain particularisms stand ready to have their tribal ways. It's also the kind of just sort of nodding heads, yes, of course, particularisms that grind out very harsh consequences through systems that are already in place. I find the mobile oil ads and the kind of appeals there to be this sort of nodding heads, yes, of course, kind of particularism that is very frightening in its appeal to relatively narrow interests, or those of United Technologies. We're seeing in the media now a flourishing of apologia of apologies in the sense of making a case for it, and a lot of it's on the part of giant commercial interests, but it's an appeal to often rather narrow national interests. The mobile oil ads that say, in effect, America needs all the energy it can get. That kind of particularism bothers me too. Or far more innocent, the particularisms of the genuine but naive good. Is this passage from Judges 9 only good proof texting, or is it an accurate reflection of actual dynamics today? I'm reading from Judges 9, 8 to 15. Once upon a time, you didn't know that the Bible stories started that way too, did you? Once upon a time, the trees came to anoint a king. And they said to the olive tree, "Be king over us." But the olive tree answered, "What? Leave my rich oil by which gods and men are honored to come and hold sway over the trees?" So the trees said to the fig tree, "Then will you come and be king over us?" But the fig tree answered, "What? Leave my good fruit and all its sweetness to come and hold sway over the trees?" Then the tree said to the vine, "Then will you come and be king over us?" But the vine answered, "What? Leave my new wine by which gladdens gods and men to come and hold sway over the trees?" Then all the trees said to the thorn bush, "Will you then come and be king over us?" And the thorn said to the trees, "If you really mean to anoint me as your king, then come under the protection of my shadow. If not, fire shall come out of the thorn and burn the cedars of Lebanon." I find a lot of circles in which, let's call it olive tree logic, is appealed to. And it's almost irresistible. It goes like this. I'm being who I am, I found my place. I'm doing a good thing. Why do otherwise? This is what I do best. But in a world of frightening interdependence and in need of some new constellations of relationships, even good particularisms, faithfully pursued, are often dangerous. Walter Wink's axiom is one that we should remember well for the 1980s. It goes like this. Every good thing by itself is evil. That's a marvelous way of putting it. Every good thing by itself is evil. And we're in a time when we need to make new constellations. And so the narrow particularisms, even good ones, can be dangerous. It can lead to thorn tree logic by way of olive tree logic. Or good particularisms with legitimate but too narrow interests easily lead to thorn tree results. Okay, facing the 80s. It's not only the increased instability that I fear is our setting. Indeed, for millions, even billions of people, that doesn't really loom quite as large as a period of grave economic doubt and anxiety. It's sobering enough to face the growing rich-poor gap while simultaneously conducting a debate around whether or not there are limits to growth. It is only added pain that which was so ardently trusted by so many economists for such a long period of time is so suddenly rendered so problematic. The comments of outgoing Secretary of Commerce Juanita Kreps are quite extraordinary for a person who was sitting in very high economic policy circles and has been a lifetime student of economic realities. When she resigned from being Secretary of Commerce in the Carter cabinet, a reporter from the Washington Post asked her whether she would return to the prestigious chair of economics that she held at Duke University. And this was her reply, "But what would I teach? I just don't believe in the old catechism anymore. That economic theory that has informed us from the middle of World War II to the present is not adequate to explain the kind of economic behavior that we're experiencing." Or, not long before his resignation from the Secretary of the Treasury, Michael Blumenthal addressed the New York Financial Writers Association in just exactly a year ago today. And I'm excerpting now of one paragraph from that speech. He was an incumbent Secretary of the Treasury at that time. Again, an extraordinary statement for someone high in the circles of national economic policy. Blumenthal, "Reliable sources of economic expertise are no longer reliable. Those wonderfully complicated mathematical models of the economy have turned treacherous. They offer as many false leads as correct ones. The experts who know most about the economy have the least certainty about it. The traditional crystal balls have been reduced to ground glass. Those who are most emphatic in their judgments and prognostications are almost without exception touched with arrogance and blessed with ignorance. Wisdom speaks these days in terms that are gray, hedged, unquotable." That's an extraordinary statement from a Secretary of the Treasury. I feel a little bit sorry for the economists these days. I've often thought if you needed any more evidence that this world is God's craziest patch of real estate, all you'd have to do would be to go to a convention of economists. Then you just ask them two questions. Number one, what's going on now? And number two, what should we do about it? You'd get the most outrageously diverse answers. I mean, even if you asked the same economist those two questions on a couple of different days, you'd get an answer which reflects great economic doubt. Alfred Kahn, President Carter's anti-inflation czar, said one day that anyone who isn't schizophrenic these days about the economy just isn't thinking clearly. And a recent Wall Street Journal headline does leave one shaking one's head. That headline, this is of some months ago, before the recession was kind of officially declared. That headline went like this: price and production data raise fears the slump may be averted. Good news is bad news, and bad news is good news. Well, I really don't want to make light of this, because the economic uncertainty probably reflects a range of real threats to the advanced industrial order, threats that are largely of its own making and that are rather deeply rooted. Energy issues are just an example of that. Well, in summary, I think the 80s, whatever they may bring, certainly now appear to be the most dangerous decade since World War II. And I'm not even mentioning nuclear weaponry, and not also non-nuclear weaponry technology, or what has happened to detente. Except to say the consequences are unthinkable. If we have very many things occurring like have occurred twice in the last 4 days. The Pentagon said last night that twice in the last 4 days the signal has come that the Soviets had launched a missile attack. And yesterday it went 4 minutes into the procedure, which is a 15-minute procedure for retaliation for that. Now, it was a computer error, but this has happened twice, and Senator Jackson has called for full-scale investigation. Well, in this kind of fragile world order, that kind of precariousness certainly makes it a dangerous decade. Actually, there are, on the other hand, some very touching signs. I felt worse about particularism and the loss of U.S. hegemony in our now multipolar world, or I would feel worse about it if it weren't for one of the great Olympic stories of this past winter. If you go by Chalet 12, you will see the flag flying proudly there. It's a blue and red flag with a gold crown, the flag of Liechtenstein. We lived in Liechtenstein for a while last year, and we thrust that population from 25,000 to 25,004. There was one place to ski in the country, no university, no airport, no passenger railroad station, one high school, no radio or TV station, cow manure instead of oil as the richest natural resource, and a per capita, well-distributed income higher than that of the United States, in fact, second highest in the world, only to Kuwait, which has very little cow manure. Liechtenstein even had to borrow a national anthem when they received the medals in the Olympic, and they borrowed the English national anthem and changed it to God Save the Prince. The score in Olympic skiing was mighty Liechtenstein 4, United States 1, including a couple gold medals. I think Liechtenstein probably thought that the advent of the multipolar world was a reference to ski poles or something. But, I mean, you know, God bless them, small is beautiful. Okay, now you're wondering what in the world happened to the announced topic, which I remind you was the church's mission in the 80s. I postponed that until now for two reasons. One, all of our thinking is contextual and perspectival. So you need to know what I see in the 80s if my images of the church's mission are to make sense. And if you have a widely contrasting view of the 80s, it's quite likely that you will also have a different notion of what the appropriate mission before us is. The second reason is that the notion of the church, too, and indeed of Christianity, is in considerable disarray these days. Great pluralism about the understanding of the faith and what the church is or ought to be about. And my notion of those things is also in considerable disarray, so I just postponed as long as I could, letting you see it, that's all. But we are the church, so let me offer what I know is a simplistic answer to the question, what ought we to be in the Hades, and then try to make that simplistic answer something else. The simplistic version is this. The mission of the church for the Hades is to let the church be the church. That doesn't take us very far. Which church are we to let the church be? A single picture will likely not do. These days, reality as we have embraced it shifts its pattern with every twist of the kaleidoscope. And if we are to be truly incarnational, we will probably have to call to mind several images that remind us of who we are and simultaneously tell us what we might be doing. So I want to offer several images. First, the church should be a community of dates rather than pumpkins. That's an image taken from a book I heartily commend to you, a book by a Brazilian theologian, Rubem Alves. The book is entitled Tomorrow's Child, and the last chapter of the book calls for the church to be a community of dates instead of pumpkins. Well, what does that mean? For Americans, I think, there will be tremendous pressures in this decade to meet short-term goals, and many, maybe most of those will be met at the expense of future generations and at the expense of the present poor. How do we get more energy? Where do we get more energy? How do we get the economy rolling again? Doesn't the poor nation's call for a new international economic order really mean more American unemployment? Furthermore, there will be, in addition to this sort of short haul mentality, I'm afraid, a kind of frantic hedonism, a sort of our version of eat, drink, and be merry. There's a late 79 issue of Newsweek that includes a piece by Michael Korda, and it's entitled Hooray for Hedonism, in which Korda argues this logic, and I quote, "The worse things get, the more sensible it is to take one's pleasure one take what pleasure one can before it's too late." End of quote. The picture that comes to my mind, borrowed from Douglas Hall's Light in Our Darkness, is that of children out for recess. I think there's lots of evidence that we're behaving like that these days. Namely, when the teacher rings the bell at the end of recess, there's a sudden spurt of intense play. The kids are going to get it all in before teacher ends recess for good. And I think we're seeing a lot of evidence that many Americans are acting as if they think time's up for unbounded affluence as a way of life, and they're just going to have one more round before teacher ends recess for good. Well, when the choices become fewer or perceived to becoming fewer, when the constraints are more numerous, and so many pressures are focused on the short haul, where is the community that dreams grander dreams and plants dates instead of pumpkins? Pumpkins you can harvest in 6 months. Dates have to be planted and tended by people who will not live to see the harvest. Dates are for future generations. Pumpkins, no doubt, will be planted by Americans in great abundance as they confront what they perceive to be a tightening future. Dates will not. It's a Jeremiah time, and like Jeremiah, we the church should buy a plot of land in exile and settle in for the longer stretch. Another image. The church's mission should be that of being a goodbye more, hello less church. A community of enough is enough. I think the goodbye more, hello less from an article by David Dodson Gray. And enough is enough is a reference to a book by John Taylor of that title. Nobody I know who is working on global food and hunger issues welcomes this decade. Nobody I know who spends their time working in development issues, rich nations, poor nations issues, welcomes this decade. David Messingbring the other day mentioned to me in a conversation that while he is optimistic about the farther future in South Africa, he is not optimistic about this decade. Nobody I know thinks that the appetite of the industrial societies of the North is anything but gluttonous, or that the rich nations will not try to corner whatever is needed to stay where they are. Nobody sees a sudden happy closing of the rich-poor abyss. Where in all of this is a community that says less is more, or at least a community among the affluent that will say less is more, even a banner community that says enough is best? Where is a community among in the rich nations that can even celebrate relinquishment, letting go? A mission of the church in the 80s is to help rich nation peoples choose for themselves a life of moderation, a life of material downward mobility. I don't like bumper sticker Christianity. There's all kinds of it in the parking lot in the seminary where I work. I don't like bumper sticker Christianity, but if we've got to have it, then one of the bumper stickers should be, say yes to less. At this point, the mission of the church borders on therapy. In that article by David Dodson Gray, he points this out, that it appears that in American society now, we have a societal-wide dynamic of death and dying that's going on. His reference is to a well-known book by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who says that people who die go through recognizable stages. Those stages are stages of denial that they're dying, anger, they're dying, then bargaining, and then a period of depression, and finally, if they proceed through all those stages, a period of acceptance and a certain kind of peace. Well, David says that those stages in that order, even though they may overlap and some may recur later, those stages are true for not just the person dying, but for family going through the grief process, and for any group of people facing what they actually are or perceive to be a matter of great loss of any kind. And he says that Americans are exhibiting those stages now with respect to our affluence. A denial that a time of affluence may be coming to an end. Anger about it, gaslighting behavior. Some bargaining over it, some depression, and in a few cases, even some acceptance, although the people didn't die at that time, they may even have found that it was something that was better rather than worse. Well, to learn to say goodbye more, hello less, is then a mission of the church in the 80s. And I hasten to add that I refer to the churches in affluent circles. In fact, all of this is done in the hope that elsewhere, among the genuinely poor, it might be a goodbye less, hello more decade. I don't think that's likely to happen on any large scale in this decade, but like dates, the seeds need to be planted now, and some community needs to be an anticipatory community. The next image is one that looks a little bit foreign to those of us who have identified ourselves as kind of social mission activists. I'm going to call this the Victoria, not Baghdad, community. What it's getting at is this. The 80s will be sufficiently convulsive in society that the church, amidst this convulsive change, needs to affirm every single ordinary good thing it can. From old liturgical formulae that still hold us together to a prayer of thanks that the sun didn't let us down but came up yet one more day. It's a mission of the church to celebrate the ordinary everyday triumphs of creation over chaos. All of this sounds very conserving and even conservative, and I mean it in exactly that way. Joan LaFrenée had a session on G.K. Chesterton this last week. One of Chesterton's books is a little one called The Man Who Was Thursday. And in that book, there's a vigorous debate between two poets, a Mr. Gregory and a Mr. Syme, and they're debating about what art is and what the business of art is about. Now, Mr. Gregory says, an artist is an anarchist. The poet delights in disorder only. And he goes on to explain why he thinks all the clerks and navvies in the railroad trains look so sad and tired, so very sad and tired. And he tells Mr. Syme this. And he says, I'll tell you why. It's because they know that the train is going right. It's because they know that whatever the place they have a ticket for, that place they will reach. It is because after they've passed Sloane Square, they know that the next station must be Victoria and nothing but Victoria. Oh, their wild rapture. Oh, their eyes like stars and their souls again in Eden if the next station were unaccountably Baker Street. Well, Syme answers this contention that disorder is what the artist is about and anarchy is what he delights in, or she. Syme answers this with equal conviction, and he says this. It is you who are unpoetical. If what you say of clerks is true, they can only be as prosaic as your poetry. The rare, strange thing is to hit the mark. The gross, obvious thing is to miss it. We feel it's epical when man with one wild arrow strikes a distant bird. Is it not also epical when man with one wild engine strikes a distant station? Chaos is dull, because in chaos the train might indeed go anywhere, to Baker Street or to Baghdad. But man is a magician, and his whole magic is in this, that when he says Victoria, lo, it is Victoria. I tell you that every time a train comes in, I feel it has broken past batteries of besiegers, and that man has won a battle against chaos. You say contemptuously that when one has left Sloane Square, one must come to Victoria. I say that one might do a thousand things instead, and that whenever I really come there, I have a sense of hairbreadth escape. And when I hear the guard shout out the word Victoria, it is not an unmeaning word. It is indeed Victoria. It is the victory of Adam. Well, a Victoria rather than Baghdad community for the 80s. That means that in the 80s, we should affirm all routine goodness and hold it high like the bread and the wine of the sacrament. Precisely in a chaotic transition time, the church should see its mission to engender awe that the sun comes up yet one more day, that a heart beats yet 24 hours, that the H2 bus, even though it's late, still traverses Adams Mill Road, that people still fall and stay in love. Eden, Gregory contends, is a symbol of the dramatically creative. So it is, and we're going to have lots of opportunity in the 80s for the dramatically creative, not least, I think, in for some new technologies. But so also is the victory of Adam, that naming by which humanity joins God in holding chaos at bay and making goodness routine. What magic it is when the conductor yells Victoria, and it is, and not Baghdad or Baker Street. Okay, then finally, a last image. The church might be the sacred stranger in secular society. 50 years ago, a sociologist by the name of Howard Becker made an important study of secularization, which is a process that has been present in all industrial orders. What Becker did was study personality types in those societies which were undergoing a kind of change that called into question the values and the perspectives of the former order of things. Older understandings of the sacred, really well-entrenched, sanctioned values, points of view, in particular, seemed overturned in the process of secularization. And the movement in such times, he found, generally seemed to be toward more secular patterns of freedom and openness. Becker found that in such settings, some persons abandon all ties to older traditions in attempting to embrace the new. In other words, for them, whatever was new simply displaced the old. Others, he said, held fast to the old amidst this convulsive change, and were more often than not simply swept aside in various ways by the new, or at least they were put on the margins with respect to their influence and place in the society. But those, Becker said, who exerted the most creative leadership in societies undergoing great change were those that he called sacred strangers in secular society. The sacred stranger embraces the new possibilities, but in doing so, does not abandon the values, meanings, insights of the old, even though it may be a passing order. Such a person often recasts older understandings, some of them which may have been buried for a while, recasts them in new constellations. Indeed, for the sacred stranger, the past provides some of the stuff of the new vision for an emerging order. The person then is the sacred stranger in the secular society, participating fully in it, but not captured by whatever is the present dominating culture. Well, what I have in mind for the church then as sacred stranger is something like this. It would mine its own peculiar traditions with greater ardor. There would be more, not less, engagement with the lives of the saints, the ancient symbols and confessions, or the lives of other members of the body of Christ in some other culture, not like ours. There would be a genuinely pious observation of the liturgical traditions and an intense adherence to the rhythm of the church year, which is a different rhythm and a different year than the one we otherwise live by. In the very midst of the shaking foundations, the tradition itself is called upon to help the necessary recasting of a new identity and a different future. But the church would be sacred stranger, that is, would be engaged at least for a season in a process of deculturation from this society. We've been, I think, wholly wrapped around the American success story and a way of life that is a way of life of conquest and control and consumption. Moving out of that will mean becoming, at least in part, a stranger to it. Yet hopefully, the church, out of sacred traditions of its own that transcend this culture and that have ties with other cultures or might receive from other cultures gifts, we can also help foster an alternative constellation even in this culture. And I guess maybe for those of us who are members of affluent circles in American society, we could start in a worse place than with a reminder by R.H. Tawney, who wrote 60 years ago, in the book Religion and the Rise of Capitalism, this sentence: "Compromise is as impossible between the Church of Christ and the idolatry of wealth, which is the practical religion of all capitalist societies, as it was between the church and the state, idolatry of the Roman Empire. Walter Brueggemann, in the book The Prophetic Imagination, thinks about all of this in this way. He takes his cues from biblical experiences. When Israel was down in Egypt land, the Exodus event gave them a new perspective, which contrasted, or a perspective that contrasted with what Brueggemann calls royal consciousness, the consciousness of official Egypt society, pharaoh consciousness. Royal consciousness, Brueggemann says, exhibited itself in a particular triad. That triad was an economics of concentrated wealth, a politics of oppression, and a religion of accessibility, namely that the gods were easily accessible. They were domesticated. The gods were good help. The gods sanctioned the politics of concentrated wealth. I mean, economics of concentrated wealth and politics of oppression. By contrast, Brueggemann says, the Hebrews and the Exodus experience initially moved towards an economics of equality, a politics of justice, and a religion of God's transcendent freedom. Go back and look at those texts. God says, according to the account, I will show mercy on those whom I will show mercy. God's transcendent freedom. Not a domesticated God. Well, you know the story from there. The Israelites from early on not only compromised their alternative triad, they even had their own version of the economics of concentrated wealth, the politics of oppression, and with the temple under Solomon, a religion of God's domestication. I had a little trouble with the text for tonight. It sounds marvelous, but under Solomon, Solomon says, God, I'm going to build you a house, and you will live there. And Solomon also says, I'm going to build me a house, and I'm going to live there. And pretty soon you've got slave labor. You've got concentrated wealth, the politics of oppression, and God domesticated. A kind of civil religion that worshipped the very golden calf that was rejected under Moses. Well, what I worry about is that in a world that's moving on far too many fronts, in the direction of what the economists call a zero-sum game, that means where more for some means less for others. I worry about an economics of affluence issuing increasingly in a politics of oppression. Now, we thought we'd transcended that by expanding economies that could bake bigger pies instead of slicing them differently. And that is not out of the question yet, but there are lots of places where we are moving toward, I'm afraid, a combination of economics of affluence and politics of oppression. And in the midst of that, there's a kind of yearning these days for a sort of quasi-religious sanction to cover those kinds of politics, or justify them as a necessity, or sometimes in a more chauvinistic vein, destiny must lead, or mission. But is there somewhere? Is there anywhere in society a community that's a sacred stranger to it? Sacred in its drawing upon a religious tradition that isn't wholly acculturated, and stranger in that it offers the outline of a different triad, economics of equality, politics of justice, and a freedom of a religion of God's freedom to do a new thing amidst the old, including a new thing in our economic and political life. All of this requires not a little foolishness, and a good bit of what David Riesman, in a nice turn of phrase, called the nerve of failure. Not the failure of nerve, but the nerve of failure. Sacred strangers tending such slow starters as dates in the vicinity of Victoria Station presents, you must agree, an uncommon scene. There certainly will be failures, including some we haven't even tried before. There's a wonderful line from Pogo. Pogo says, "We've got faults we haven't even used yet." And I think this decade will give us opportunity to use some faults we didn't even know we had. Pogo also says, you could write all of this around Pogo. Pogo also says, what we are facing is a set of insurmountable opportunities. But as a church, we live from memory and hope. The memory is that we've all been all of these places before. Egypt, Israel, Babylon, Rome, Constantinople, and we were sustained. And the hope rests in the fact that the creative task is possible because it's already happened, and dying and rising again. And so I think we can go out with good courage and maybe even joyfully if we continually are in touch with the ground of memory and hope. In that, the church's trust is certain, even though we see the 80s only through a smoky glass. The church trusts in transformation because the possibility is God, and for no other reason. For when hope was hopeless, Abraham, contemplating his own body as good as dead, and knowing as well the deadness of Sarah's womb, yet put his trust in God, the God who makes the dead live and summons things that are not yet into existence as if they already were. Those phrases from Romans 4. In that God we have faith and to go out, and I think even with good courage. Well, have I run on?
Long, no doubt.
Yeah. We do have a little bit of time. Let's get response, comment, questions, disagreement. Poland's a good place for getting out whatever is within. Assessments of what we're looking at in the 80s. Pictures, understanding the pictures of the church, whatever. Yeah,
David. Would you apply some of this, some of what you're saying in relation to the electronic church, as Martin Newhouse called it? Because it seems to me that that is, if we talk about the church in the 80s, we need to have some sense of our relationship with, you know, with what is increasingly being called the electronic church, TV Christianity.
Yeah. I have so many, there are probably other people that know more about it than I do. There certainly has been a growth in the appeal of the electronic church, referring to a proliferation of the use of TV by certain groups. I mean, I don't know them well, so someone else I've talked about. I've seen some of Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, Robert Schumer. What little I've seen bothers me a great deal, because I think it is exactly what Marx regarded religion to be at its worst, namely an opium for the people. So often there's I hear the gospel of wealth all over again on many of those programs. And in this setting, that sounds to me like a way of trying to give people a kind of security and confidence when they have great anxiety, but do it by way of making promises that for which there is precious little sort of empirical reality, but other people might have some response to that. They have a different,
comments on the electronic church? You were asking sort of how do those of us who don't find ourselves there relate to us?
I mean, I think that there is a certain, you define it in terms of opiate, but I think there is a certain security that increasingly in the world that we as Christians walk around in, we meet up with people who tune in pretty regularly to those shows and who take from them a sense of certainty that I find real hard to relate to, and even to deal with. I share some of your discomfort, but I don't know how to respond to it. And it seems to me that the kind of church you're talking about does stand opposed to that kind of church.
Yes.
And I wonder, it's one thing for me to oppose it in the form of saying that I'm uncomfortable with it, but when I get there on the street in the face of it, do I have some responsibility?
Yeah. How do you talk to one
another? Yeah. And do I just keep my mouth shut when someone starts going on about how great this is, or do I actually offer an alternative witness?
I have real serious misgivings, but again, certainly no clarity about the recent move on the part of the United Methodist Church at the annual conference. Just concluded, the United Methodist Church decided to buy a TV station for $25 billion. So that there would be a different kind of message coming from television than that of the electronic church. I just have all sorts of ambiguous feelings about that. Yeah.
I'm not sure I can express myself exactly in the way I want to say it. I was not always Christian, and so obviously I've not always been Lutheran. And I guess to this extent, I have an appreciation for the electronic church. And that is that I really believe that deep in the heart of every person is a desire to know Jesus Christ, and that that is where our salvation comes from. And I think it's really dangerous to judge any method of allowing a person to hear about Jesus Christ and his gospel message, and that if the electronic church isn't doing it, then it is our job that we should be doing it, that we have the Great Commission to go and to teach others about Jesus and to bring about their baptism.
I think the problem is that Jesus Christ that's portrayed there is not the Lord that I know, and so you're absolutely right. If that gets put across to people, it's our job to somehow counter that, because that's, in many instances, a theology of glory. And Douglas John Hall, in his book, or when we asked him to be on faculty, said he was so grateful because the Lutherans were the one people that had the heritage of a theology of the cross and understood what the theology of the cross was all about. And that if we held on to nothing else, we certainly ought to hold on to the theology of the cross. And the difference between theology of cross and theology of glory, I think, is something that has to be said again and again and again. And what's coming over TV, to me, is theology of glory. And that's not the Jesus that I'd like people to know.
I guess I'm not really sure that I understand what you're saying, but what I do understand is that there may be some hearts out there that are touched in a new way to hear the message of salvation and have never heard it before. And I think in a lot of instances that we have to trust our God and our Lord, that He will use that too as a tool to draw people to Him. And that even though initially they may not see it the same way, that it is providing maybe an opportunity for God to use that to draw them to the Word of God and into activity within the confines of a more structured church.
Other comments on that or anything else?
I don't have a comment. I you certainly stirred my thinking well this morning. But I do have a very real question, and partly stimulated by what this young woman has said. How do you become, or how are you, the sacred stranger in secular society without appearing, or maybe even being, so self-righteous that you have destroyed the very thing that you are attempting to do or be?
I mean, that certainly is the risk that is taken whenever you talk about a form of the church which tends to be sectarian in character, rather than one that is, tries to be sort of suffused throughout the whole society. Because this picture of the church is one which really does depend upon close fellowship, a high degree of discipline, and a sense of rather intense community. And those characteristics are characteristics of a more sectarian version of church. And again, that risk of self-righteousness is the one that's there, because the community kind of lives from its distinctiveness from, while at the same time its participation in the society. So I don't know the answer in terms of how that's prevented, other than the sort of theological response that community.
You keep on trying, I guess.
Well, and that community, as all others, also stands under the same judging God, and is as sinful as. I mean, that I can understand the theological response of a Luther that says that all of us are always at the same time justified and sinners, and it will be as true there as elsewhere. But the psychology of it is exactly the psychology that you point to. The closeness of the community results in, and distinctiveness of it results in, the temptations to self-righteousness.
I was just wondering, someone else?
No, go ahead.
I was just wondering if I haven't listened to the electronic church over much, because it happens at the same time when we go to the Nago, I started, well, microphone.
Yes, a different electronic church. We tape here.
But My impression is that the electronic church gets so very, very wealthy because it tells people what they want to hear and makes them feel good without having to do anything. I hope that isn't too much of an oversimplification.
If it is true, it has a great deal in common with the non-electronic church.
We struggle along with a hope for a budget that we never make, and we never have any. We have trouble making ends meet, and the electronic church, the money rolls in by the bail every day, and they can do just about whatever they want to. So I can't think of any other reason for that difference, is that it pleases people. It doesn't challenge them to the Great Commission or anything like that. It soothes them, so to speak, I would say.
Although there have been many people who have certainly attested to significant changes in their lives, that were difficult. It isn't simply, it may be a soothing for lots, but for some others there would be important exceptions to that.
I think the kind of gratification that the electronic church offers is one, what bothers me are the things that it says about politics and about American nationalism and that kind of thing. Some of the theology, the salvation theology and, you know, as you were saying, bringing people to Christ or introducing people to Christ who haven't known that kind of personal relationship, that, I think, you know, I go along with wherever people get it, then that's a start for them. But what bothers me are all of the political stuff that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes think that the electronic church tells people what they want to hear about the greatness of American political tradition, you know. And then our Lutheran pastors, I participate in a Lutheran clergy group in Seattle once a week, study the text coming up and talk a little bit. And a couple of weeks ago, one of the pastors said, said to the rest of the group, what are you saying to your people about Iran? And everyone in the group kind of said, well, we stay off that subject. And I think that there's a sense in which we who have participated in the tradition of the cross are afraid to confront contemporary political issues because we know it leads to the cross. You know, for a pastor, it can get him in hot water in his congregation pretty fast. So that we're kind of neutralized on political issues, whereas the electronic church deals with them, and that's part of our inability to relate to something that we're uncomfortable with in the electronic church. That we, intellectually, we know the difference between the theology of glory and theology of cross, but we're not always willing to stand up and to walk to the cross.
Tom?
Yeah, I often acknowledge one of my failings as a teacher is that I don't understand this powerful medium. And I often think I ought to take time to watch TV, watch the top 10 programs, which I don't find much in for me, but I ought to do it to understand my students. And I think the same thing, I sense the same thing in this discussion. We're talking about something that's a powerful force in religious society, but it hasn't said much to us. But we're not trying to understand what it is in the message of these powerful people on TV. On church people and non-church people alike. I sense that you feel the same way I do, that I kind of wish I understood it, what it is in that grabs people in this new medium, or this not new medium, but this universal medium, but boy, I sure don't understand it, because it means nothing to me.
It seems to me that a lot of what is offered, whether it be Jerry Farwell or Robert Schubert or whoever, a lot of what is offered to the person listening that comes across as comfort is the fact that the world is indeed just what you described. It's uncertain, it's anxiety-ridden, and you can just turn on the tube and here's a message that says God loves you and he's going to take care of you, and if you love Jesus, you're going to sell $1 million worth of real estate tomorrow. And you're going to be in great shape because you're going to have this financial security. God's going to make everything come out right.
Yeah.
And I mean, there isn't a whole lot in that for some of us brought up in the Lutheran tradition that says that's not what God promised. He promised to be with you, but how it's going to be day to day, that isn't necessarily going to be all on the plus side.
Isn't it true that the closer the closer that Jesus got to the cross, the smaller the crowd was that followed him.
Yeah.
And I guess this is happens with the theology of the cross, that if it was practiced, preached truly today, also. But it's not the deal.
I can't say that of all television preachers, but many of them, it seems to me. And not only do we have the national ones, we have our own share of local ones in LA. Many of them certainly appeal rather to the concept of separation. Don't think about all those terrible things you read in your newspaper. Because you and God are going to work it out for you. They just, in essence, turn off any kind of rational view of the society. It's like withdraw from all of that.
I'm looking at the time, and dinner is at 12:30, so I think we'll... it's another Holden session. You always end a Holden session on a semicolon. There are no periods around here. It's just an ongoing session with a lot of semicolons.
Or questions.
Yeah, question mark. Yeah.